Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. It's David Summers. And here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. Let's step back into the ring and back into time. Let's get wall to wall, treetop tall, with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Welcome, everybody, to another Studcast. Ron, you are riding a runaway horse lately with new fans jumping on from all over the podcast world. So what you do is totally unique in this fast-rising form of communication, and you are becoming a real powerhouse.
Well, Dave, I'm enjoying the ride, too, man, just as much, I think, as everybody else seems to be. And I know of no other podcast in the world that focuses on one family and the accomplishments, and not only the accomplishments, but the disappointments of that family, and especially a podcast with far more than 350 hours and 6 years of weekly stories, and it's still going, man.
No doubt. Your new hidden history lessons have taken fans from the 1880s, and Farmer Burns through legendary Frank Gotch, the Gold Dust Trio, your grandfather's days, and last Studcast, through the inception of the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance. So where are we riding today, Stud?
Well, today's hidden history lesson is going to ride us, man, into the unique lifestyle of a professional wrestler, something we've never talked about, I think, and, you know, and what it took to be able to deal with a sports life different than any other. And there's no doubt about that. Professional wrestler's life was crazy. And I'm going to wrap that story around my cousin, Jimmy Golan's life. We're going to kind of go back and talk a little bit about his horrible back injury on April 8th, 1980, and had changed everything for him.
Wow. Okay. In other words, you're really going to be taking us on another ride into wrestling history, into what it was like to be a professional wrestler. So one that fans have never had the opportunity to hear before from the man who many consider to be one of America's greatest storytellers. All right. So, Stud, where does this hidden history lesson begin?
Well, let's begin this one, man, with what it was like to be a professional wrestler. Obviously, it was like no other sport in the world. When you became a professional wrestler, there was no other sport anywhere that left you all alone with your future, man, having no idea what your future was, as a matter of fact. You were a complete unknown, and you definitely weren't going to get paid in your retirement, I can tell you that. So you had no guarantee of a salary or even a job, basically. After spending countless hours on the mat trying to learn your craft, you didn't know whether you were going to find a job or not. You didn't even know if you were going to get a job after going through all of it. So, wow, it was a big, big question mark if you wanted to be a professional wrestler. So you were going to move, basically, from one part of the country to another, and you probably weren't going to get to settle down until your career was done. And if you got married, your family was likely to be constantly on the move with you, and maybe never get to settle down as well. So if you finally got selected to be a full-time professional wrestler, you had no idea what you were going to even be paid or if you were ever going to be able to survive and make a career out of it even. If you got hurt badly, you had to live with those injuries forever. So if you got selected to be a full-time professional wrestler, you had no insurance and you could never get it. And if you told anyone what you actually did for a living, you know, that if it was an insurance person, and as soon as you said, they said, "What do you do?" "I'm a professional wrestler." They would go, "Oh, no, I don't think so, sir."
They would just start laughing at you.
We don't cover that.
Right.
So if you got hurt badly because your profession was considered that dangerous, and at the same time it was considered dangerous enough that the insurance people would turn you down, but then it was called fake at the same time. So, I mean, how could it be fake if it's all fake? How the heck could they not cover you?
Right.
So if you finally, after all this, if you got selected to be a professional wrestler, you became a part of a fraternity of athletes, basically, that were all on their own. You didn't have teammates. Yeah, you weren't a part of any organization like a team or backed by the National Basketball Association, the NBA, or the NFL, or anything like that. You were absolutely out there on a limb. And Dave, in a way, the limb already had a crack in it most of the time. So, that's not where you wanted to be, man. It was not something you really wanted to jump on. So when you started, you were going to spend a great deal of time during the course of the next maybe 10, 20 years of your life riding in a car. And if you were lucky, it would be with two or three other wrestlers, and you could split some of the gas expenses with them. That's what we used to do back in the 70s and the 60s. That's changed a little bit now because the business has changed so much. But you spent your life in the car. You could work with guys that ride with the same four guys. One guy would drive his car, and then the next person would drive their car the next trip. Then you split the gas expenses, if you were in these cars, you were hearing, man, not only were you hearing them, but you started telling stories because you had all these hours on the road. And what were you going to do if you didn't tell stories? You didn't have some way to communicate constantly, basically. So wrestlers became, professional wrestlers became something different than all other athletes, I think, because of the way that you had to live your life. And so you constantly started pulling ribs on each other. And when you did that, you became even closer friends with guys. When you could rib each other and do something crazy and everybody laugh and just roar about it, it was a totally different type of profession. So if you weren't lucky enough to be in one of those cars, you really had a much more difficult road to travel, and your chances of success was even less likely. So if the ring didn't get you, your chances of getting killed or maimed in a car wreck very well might get you. That's for sure. A lot of guys died on the roads, and a lot of guys got hurt and ended their careers in car wrecks.
Wow.
So you basically learn to keep your mouth shut. You keep your eyes and your ears open and to learn as much as you could as fast as possible and work your way up the cards as fast as you could until you kind of assured yourself that, I think I'm going to make it in this business, right? I think I will be able to survive it. So this is where I want to kind of bring in my cousin, Jimmy Golden, because we're talking about getting injured here and then surviving it. And Jimmy had just suffered a tragic injury, man, after already surviving 12 years in the business. At this point, when Jimmy got hurt, he was 29 years old, and it looked like he was done in the sport, that was going to be the end of it for him. His back was so bad, and he suffered such a bad injury. And he was one of those professional wrestlers I mentioned earlier. He had no insurance, and he was never going to be able to get it. And, his predicament was pretty dire, man. He was in a bad, bad spot. So before the last Studcast, eight-man tag, where Jimmy was hurt, he had been having a very bad back problem for a long time. And just getting out of bed for Jimmy every morning was hard for him. You know, and he had to have his wife help him get out lots of times because he just couldn't, his back was just going on him. And he'd been seeing chiropractors for months. He wasn't getting any success from that. But he was still going to work every night. And he was in the worst possible job. He had the worst possible job to have a bad back because he was going to get slammed and suplexed and all these other things that hurt you bad anyway. But when you had a bad back to begin with, it was agony. It was sheer agony for him. So after spending time in the hospital after the injury with no chance for recovery afterward, he left his home, Pensacola. And I mentioned this, I think, in the last studcast. And he, before going to Birmingham, he actually went back to his father's home in Dyersburg, Tennessee, to try and recover there.
Okay, isn't Dyersburg, Tennessee, the small town where, I think where your grandfather Roy settled down originally when he came to Tennessee and where you and Robert were born, actually?
That's it. That's it. The same little Dyersburg, Tennessee. And not only was Rob and I born there, but Jimmy was born there. So Jimmy's father and his uncle, whose name was Philip, they'd been in the wrestling business for years. But at this particular time when Jimmy got hurt, they had gotten out of the wrestling business and they bought themselves a gas station business in Dyersburg, Tennessee. And it appeared Jimmy was done for good in wrestling, you know, when he went back to Dyersburg. And he wasn't getting any better. He moved in with his dad, him and his wife. And, you know, and for they spent several months there. And he was under a chiropractor's care. And he went to work for his father and their uncle in the gas station business. And no doubt, man, there was a world of difference between the gas station business and what he had been doing. That's for sure. So he wasn't going to get slammed or suplexed, but he wasn't going to have the same lifestyle in any form or fashion. So after Jimmy living several months in Dyersburg, Bill and Philip, they bought another gas station. This one was in Alabaster, Alabama, which is just south of Birmingham. And Jimmy moved to the southern part of Birmingham, you know, south area of Birmingham, and he took over the operation of their new station. And Jimmy was still one of the owners of the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory and was receiving dividends from Southeastern every month as the territory was doing very well at that time. You know, so he at least had that income coming in. And a real quick little story here. Jimmy hadn't had any contact for months with a lot of the boys. They didn't know how to contact him. So he's living there and he's running the station, Alabaster, Alabama, which is just right there on the freeway, Interstate 65. And a Mongolian Stomper and Don Carson happened to get off and get gas in his gas station. And there comes Jimmy Golden to help him when they put ready to pump the gas. Wow. Which back in those days, you bumped the gas.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So, you know, and they went nuts like, oh, well, Jimmy, what in the heck, man? So, you know, so just that's a pretty much a huge coincidence that out of that whole 400-mile or 250-mile trip from Pensacola up there that you would stop at the gas station that Jimmy Golden was running.
For real. Wow.
So it was about this same time that we, the owners of the Southeastern, made a decision. We wanted to buy Birmingham, and with Birmingham, we were going to try to get the rest of northern Alabama. We were going to buy it from Dick Gulas, who was my grandfather Roy's partner for many, many years out of Nashville, Tennessee. Nick was selling his pieces of his territory because he wanted to retire. He was older, and it was a tough time. We were doing great, but a lot of territories weren't at that time. You know, and it was going to greatly expand our existing territory, man, to be able to pick up Birmingham, largest city in Alabama, Huntsville up there, big city. I mean, we were going to get the, you know, uh, the the far western side of the state there with the good little cities there along that northern part of the state. And wow, it was going to be a good deal for us. And Jimmy, about that same time, when he went to take over the gas station, he got hooked up with a chiropractor and down there in that area. And Jimmy told me, once I found this guy, Ron, he goes, he changed everything for me. And he said the guy gave him just a sheet of paper. After he had adjusted him many times, mm-hmm. he gave him a sheet of paper, and it was yoga exercises on a sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. And he said the chiropractor told me, he says, if you'll do these things that you see on this sheet of paper here, mm-hmm. he says, I can't help you as much as this will help you. And that's where Jimmy started to make a recovery to be able to get back in the sport.
Wow, so it does have a happy ending.
Yeah, the story has a happy ending, right?
Yeah.
It certainly does. But it was going to be a while before that happened. Jimmy was away from the sport entirely for more than 8 months, close to 9 months, from April 8th, 1980, which is the card that we talked about last week in which he was injured. He didn't start wrestling again until the last week of December in 1980. So when Jimmy returned after the back problem that almost ended his career, he was going to be in the ring for another 40 years with a guy that had a bad back and about got him out of the business. He was going to be in the ring for 40 years after that. Jimmy had one of the longest careers in the history of professional wrestling.
Wow. I mean, to me, that alone is a tribute to him. That's a great way to start this studcast, and I know we have a tremendous card for the third week in April of 1980 when we go back in time for all three major Southeastern Gulf Coast markets. Specifically, on Tuesday, April 15th, 1980, we're going to go to Mobile, Alabama, in the main arena of the Municipal Auditorium Complex and set that up for a stud. Who was on that card?
Man, that was a beautiful building, man. 10,000 seats. On this particular night, April 15th, right in the middle of April, I guess that's tax day, man. seats, we had six matches in the building with 18 participants on the card. There were three referees on this card. And the opening match was Ricky Fields against the Avenger. Roy Lee Welch was facing Bill Dromo. Eddie Boulder was wrestling the still cocky Randy Rhodes at this point. You know, he wasn't as cocky as he had been, but he was still feeling himself. And then a Brass Knucks match, the world's Brass Knucks champion, Fabulous Don Fargo, was going to be taking on Charlie Cook. And then a United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match, the champion Norvell Austin was going to be defending against the former champion Tony Charles. And if Charles did not win his belt back, this was going to be his last chance. It was the last shot at getting his belt back. So then the main event was another eight-man tag. Jimmy was no longer there, but this time all eight guys were going to be in the ring at the same time. It was going to be inside a steel cage. It was going to have two referees in the ring. It was Georgia Jawjacker, Joe LeDuc, Robert, and me. And we were facing the Mongolian Stomper, the Big C, Dr. Bill Irwin, and they had a mystery partner, the guy that was going to take the place of Jimmy Golden, who had been injured the week before.
All right, a really fantastic card, and definitely one that's going to need those 10,000 seats. All right, so how about the TV that promoted this whole thing and set it all up?
Well, this TV show opened up with a video of an extremely rare match from 4 days earlier in Mobile, Alabama, which had been the week before, that involved two matches. One match kind of turned into two matches back to back. So after Charlie ran down a brief explanation of what was coming up on this TV show, he invited out Charlie Cook. Charlie got a great hand. Charlie was becoming a real star for Southeastern, and he was a great talent. He deserved it. And so Cook didn't look it, though, when he came to the set, because he had a big swollen face and a patched up busted eye, courtesy of Don Fargo. So that's why this, we're going to show a video here, and this video is going to lap over from one match into the match following it. So Charlie welcomed him and briefly explained a small piece of what they were going to watch, and also the fact that Charlie Cook was no stranger to boxing. And, so the video opened up with Cook, man, dancing and blasting Don Fargo with some big shots, man, that dropped Fargo for an 8 count right at the end of the fourth round of that boxing match. So Charlie, had his chance to show off a little bit in the video, and then it picked up the action to the beginning of the fifth round. And so Cook kind of drew everybody's attention to the video here. He said, keep an eye on Fargo over there. And Don Fargo was sitting on his stool. They had stools. They put him in the ring just like boxers were doing their boxing. And Fargo was sitting on his stool, and he was kind of shaking his hands and bent over and, during this rest period. And when he got up, he turned his back to the referee, and he turned his back to Charlie. When he turned around, he just charged right into Cook. And it became pretty obvious right then. The fans could see it on the screen. Fargo didn't have a glove on his right hand anymore. He had a brass metal knuck on there instead. So Fargo had changed the match from a boxing match to a brass knucks match, except he was the only guy with the brass knucks. So he waded into Charlie Cook, man. It looked like Ali into Joe Frazier, man. I mean, and he did a lot of damage right away, considering what Cook's face looked like to people sitting there seeing him on the screen. So in the video, the referee started ringing the bell. He disqualified Fargo immediately, obviously, but that didn't stop Fargo. He just kept going, and he kept going after, at this point, the pretty bloody Charlie Cook. And so Charlie Platt asked the director to stop the tape because he's going to show this tape in the next segment of the show. So Charlie asked him to stop the tape, and then he told fans that we'll be coming back to watch the rest of it later in the show. And then Platt asked Charlie if he was ready for this upcoming brass knucks match with Fargo. After he beat him in the boxing match, he won the boxing match. It was no contest, basically. But, what happened afterward made it all a big difference in it. So Cook said, he told Charlie, he said, as a 9-year National Football League Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker, he goes, I've been beat up before, Charlie. But he goes, I'm looking forward to this, man, to this brass knucks match. He goes, because I'm going to have a pair on, too.
All right. So how about the first TV match? Who was in that?
Well, the man that messed up Charlie Cook's face, man, 4 days earlier was in that match. So Platt asked Cook if he'd like to stay. He was going to see Don Fargo in the ring, and he went and make some comments maybe about the match. So Cook took him up on the invitation, saying he didn't, he couldn't wait to see Fargo's ugly face again. I said, put it something like that. Fargo had an ugly face. And those couldn't be any more honest words, I'll tell you. Because anybody that ever saw Don Fargo's face knew what Charlie was alluding to. So he was probably in his early 40s, Fargo at this point, but he looked like he was 80 years old. His face was scarred everywhere, from his forehead all the way down to his chin. Scars going in all directions.
Wow.
He just really, really, he was a warrior.
Yep.
From my father's day.
Yep.
I mean, he was wrestling back when my father was, and he's still in there doing it. And he did very little wrestling in this opening match on TV. Instead, man, he was honing in on his skills, man. He was out there practicing, getting ready for his brass knucks match against Cook in the next show. Then the second segment of the show had another guy patched up. Tony Charles was sitting there at the set with Charlie Platt. and they watched the continuation of the first video. So what had happened was, Tony was extremely upset, and he explained, how he was back in the back watching this match between Fargo and Charlie Cook, and then he saw what Fargo did, and he said, as soon as my match was going to be, I was going to have an opportunity to win my United States belt back from Norvell Austin. But he said, as soon as I saw Fargo pull those brass knucks out, and he started pounding Cook with him, and Cook was down and out, and he said, I couldn't stop myself. He said, I went to help. I went down to see if I could at least get Fargo off of Charlie Cook, and he said, obviously the bell was ringing, and Fargo wasn't going to stop. So Charlie, at that point, asked the director to, continue the video. So it showed Tony going into the ring and trying to stop Charlie Cook from getting a heck beat out of him any further. And he finally got Fargo off of Cook, and then he got Cook over into a corner of the ring, and he was trying to get him out of the ring. And then Fargo went over, and Tony had his back turned to him, turned him around, spun him around, and he hit him over the eye, man, with the knucks, and busted him open, and then he just left the ring. So now you got both Cook and Tony Charles bleeding. Hmm. And so Charlie was, now he was trying to help Tony instead of Tony helping him. And so Norvell Austin, he's the champion. He stands back there and he sees all this going on. He grabs his belt and he just goes running to the ring and jumps in there and he says, start the match. Let's start the match, right? So the announcements was made, and Charles was still kind of hanging in the corner, trying to get his senses back, bleeding, and the bell rang to start the match. Well, as soon as the bell rang, Austin could do whatever he wanted to, and he just raced across the ring and slammed Tony into the turnbuckles head first. Then they body slammed him, and then he covered him. And when he covered him, the referee started to count. Austin put both his feet on the bottom rope, like he had beaten Charles the week before, the same way. Referee counted him out and never saw the feet again. Second week in a row, Norvell Austin has won a match with his feet on the ropes. So then Tony yelled for him to stop the video. He'd seen enough, that everybody else had seen enough too. And he said Austin had asked Don Curtis, the Southeastern Commissioner, to give him he told him, I'll give Tony one more title shot, but if he doesn't win, I don't ever want to have to defend against him again. And so, Tony wasn't happy about it. You know, he said, hey, that's pretty cruel. That's not the way the sport is normally done. You usually get these return matches. But he said, if that's the way it's going to be, he said, I promise the fans I'm going to do the best I can to get myself a win. And he said, and then he said, I got to tell you this, Charlie. He says, when I get my belt back, and I am going to win, I'm going to get my belt back. He says, I want to defend it the very next week against Don Fargo because of what he did to me earlier. And, the studio pop, man, as soon as he got up, he left the set.
Wow, good deal. Okay, so how about the next TV match? Who was in that?
Well, the present United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Norvell Austin. And his opponent was already in the ring when Austin came out of the dressing room with his championship belt. And because he saw Charles leave the set, he went straight to the set rather than go into the ring. And so when he got there, he held up his belt in the air and he yelled, Tony Charles probably in the back. You could see the monitor in the dressing room. He yelled at Tony Charles and he said, you better take a good look at this because you're never going to wear this belt again. And then he just took off straight to the ring, shot in and underneath the bottom rope, slid in there, and tore into the guy he was wrestling. Didn't take long for that match, I'll tell you that.
Wow.
And he beat his guy with his patented head, diving headbutt coming off the top ropes. Then he paraded around the ring with his belt held over his head.
All right, this is a good place. Why don't we do this? Let's take our break now. And when we come back, we're going to find out who and what happened and who is in the personality profile. That's coming up when this Studcast continues. All right, Studcast fans, on the break, let's remind you that Ask the Stud question and answer shows are one of the most popular on the YouTube Southeastern Rewind channel. Every one of them seems to get better and better. Fans ask phenomenal questions, and the Stud responds with fantastic answers. If you've never heard one of these Ask the Stud shows, you're missing something very special. If you're a true fan of the sport, you will find 16 of these unique shows and get a totally new perspective of professional wrestling on YouTube Southeastern Rewind. Check it out. Okay, Studcast fans, welcome back to another Studcast. This one is episode number 346. 346 of these. It's called Joe LeDuc Goes Down Second in 2 weeks. Okay, so as we get back into the second half of this, who and what was the focus of the weekly personality profile? Set it up for us, Stud.
Well, you know, you kind of with the, just talking about the title of this particular Studcast, it kind of leads us into what was on the personality profile in a way. This was kind of about Jimmy Golden, still part of it. So three of the four wrestlers that were scheduled to be in the cage match the following week were on this profile. You had the Mongolian Stomper, you had Dr. Bill Irwin out there, and you had the Big C, who obviously was going to do all the talking. So the focus was on the video. There was a video in this of the last eight-man tag the week before, and it showed Jimmy Golden and what happened to Jimmy and what appeared to be maybe his last wrestling match in his career. So the Big C tried his best to blame Joe LeDuc for what happened to Golden. He says he said if Joe LeDuc hadn't been so fat that when Jimmy Golden picked him up to slam him, he wouldn't have collapsed, you know, and he said the video showed Joe LeDuc did go down, and he went down very awkwardly on top of Golden because Jimmy went down. Oh, it was horrible. Never forget how bad it looked. So the video showed the three of them helping Golden put him on the stretcher when they were taking him out after that he had collapsed, and he ended up losing the match, obviously. LeDuc had to do was roll over and cover him. He wasn't going to kick out. He couldn't even move. And so it showed the three of them put Golden on the stretcher, and then they walked him as the stretcher rolled him out to the ambulance. It was parked in the back of the arena. And, wow, it was basically the end of Jimmy Golden. So the Big C screamed for them to stop the video, and he got serious at that point, saying that his team already had a mystery man, and they knew who was going to be taking Jimmy Golden's place next week in the steel cage match, and they promised Jimmy Golden that the Big C promised Jimmy that Joe LeDuc's fat ass was going to pay for what happened to him. So Charlotte Platt, you know, asked why they would not just tell everybody right now who's the mystery man. Why the heck call him a mystery man? Why don't you just tell us who the guy is? So the three of them kind of got a big laugh out of that. You know, like, where are you kidding? Right? So the Big C said, you know, all these rednecks sitting here, you know, and the bleachers were right by the profile set. And he said, all these rednecks sitting here pointing at the people on the bleachers, he said, those rednecks at home, man, they're going to find out sooner than you think about who the mystery man is. So the studio crowd, they exploded in booze. These guys were pretty well disliked, man, and the three of them left the set.
All right, so the suspense continues. All right, so, but how about the next match? Who was in that one?
Well, another young star, man, trying to push his way up the card. Eddie Boulder, who's going to be the future Brutus the Barber Beefcake, working out of the WWF, I think it maybe was back in those days, even before WWE started. So Eddie Boulder had been there. He'd been on the opening matches and the first three matches on the card, and he was trying to work his way up. And the mere fact that Boulder was in the ring, it sent another young star who wasn't supposed to, decided he's going to go to the set with Charlie Platt to talk about this. And that was Randy Rhoads. And he'd been working hard, man, to get noticed again. He'd had that short run against Tony Charles in a very controversial situation where he got up to higher on the card. And the fact that Rhoads was on the opening part of the card the following week, and he was going to be against Eddie Boulder, I guess that was enough to let Randy Rhoads think it's okay for him to just push his way into sitting down with Charlie and, going in wanted to, I guess, talk about Boulder's match. So we're on one of the few territories. We did things so much different than a lot of other territories. We're one of the few that ever had more than one, and at the most two angles going at a time. That's the way most bookers book their territory. They had one main event. They sometimes had a second match that meant a little something under that main event. But then the other four or five matches were pretty much meaningless. So this upcoming steel cage card had three angles on it all at once. Three of them going on. Had the eight-man tag. It had the United States Junior Championship match. And it had a brass knucks match. So my feeling as a booker was that if you had good talent, even way down the card, which we always tried to do, is had the best wrestlers we could all the way from the first match to the last. You benefited both the card and the show if you could involve as many of those young stars as possible, move them up the card. So this was an example of that concept, these two young guys. So these two were going to have the opportunity to highlight themselves for a few weeks and see where it went. So Rhoads had already been there, and now it was kind of Boulder's turn to see what he could do, kind of make a little name for himself. So while the TV match was going on, Rhoads started on Charlie by asking him, why is it that I'm not in the ring instead of the pretty boy up there? So that's kind of what Eddie Boulder was. He was kind of a pretty boy. That was a good way to describe him. So Charlie told him, he says, hey, Randy, I'm not the matchmaker. He says, you need to talk to Don Curtis about that. I don't put the matches together. So Rhoads continued on with a bunch of other derogatory comments about Boulder while the match was gone until the match ended. And Eddie got a big win. It was a good win for him. And at the same time, Randy Rhoads got a little heat, by going out there and pushing himself into the spotlight, even though he wasn't supposed to be there.
All right, so it seems like it's time for the last TV match of the show. Who is in that one?
Well, it had the same four wrestlers as a team that had been in last week's last match. One of the eight-man teams was going to be in the upcoming steel cage match. And so that was Jawjacker, Joe LeDuc, Robert, and myself. We were going to be in a eight-man tag match right there on TV, like we had been. Actually, this is going to be the third week of one of those. We'd been in two of them, and the other team was in the first week. So the studio crowd, they seemed just as pleased to see us, man, as the week before. They didn't mind the fact that we're coming back to have another one of these. So the match was against a team that wasn't quite as strong as probably the team that we had beat the week before. And we were about to finish that match when all of a sudden out of the Heels dressing room came Mongolian Stomper, Big C, and Dr. Bill Irwin. Irwin had his rope with him, his lasso. And they surrounded the ring on three sides. And boy, as soon as they showed up and as soon as it became pretty clear that something's going to happen here, the studio went nuts. So the Mongolian Stomper, he went right after the Georgia Jawjacker. Dr. Bill Irwin, man, he flipped his lasso around Rob's leg, and he drug him Rob was in the ring. He drug him over to the ropes and tied him into the rope. And the Big C jumped up on the apron. And when he did, he was coming after me. I flipped him over into the ring. And all four of those guys that we were wrestling in the match, they just disappeared. They didn't want to be any part of it, I guess. And so Joe LeDuc went after Bill Irwin. And he had already, you know, he went over there to help Bill Irwin tie Rob up a little bit better. And so, you know, so that's when here came the mystery man. So, you know, I guess Carson, the Big C, pretty much said the right thing that, you know, they're going to find out pretty soon here who it is. Well, they found out a few minutes later. So he only had one man in mind, Ron Bass, and that was Joe LeDuc. And last week, Bass had been in a match, and then he told the reason he came to Southeastern was to get even with Joe LeDuc, that he'd been looking for him for almost a year. And he finally found out where he was, and he said he was here to send him to the hospital. So Bass didn't come in the ring alone. He brought his trusty bull rope with him, man. And so I'm sure people could hear that metal bell that was tied around the center of that bull rope chime out downtown Dothan, 6 miles away, when he hit Joe LeDuc in the head with it. Wow, it just, it was unbelievable. No way you could keep from hearing that outside the building. So, and blood spurted across the ring, man. Joe went down face first. He never moved. Bass didn't care that Joe was out and unconscious. He kind of sat down on top of him and just started pounding him in the back of the head with his fist. It was like total pandemonium in the studio by this point. And Tony Charles and Eddie Boulder, they came to help. They tried to get into the ring, but Rose and Austin, who's going to be their opponents, they stopped them from getting in, and they started fighting on the outside. So there were bodies lying everywhere. Charlie Platt called for the director to go to black. You know, said, let's try to get some order restored. Yeah, let's just go to black. So it was close to the end of the TV show anyway. And as then they went to a 2-minute commercial break. So there was still about 4 minutes of showtime in the show after the commercial break. So Bass and his boys, his team, went to the set with Charlie while the rest of us were still in the ring. We were trying to get Joe back conscious again. Joe was just, he was gone. And as soon as the commercial break was over, Bass started screaming that he was the mystery man. I'm the mystery man. And, you know, he said, I did what I came to do. I put Joe LeDuc in the hospital. You won't be seeing him anywhere but carried out of this ring here. And he won't be in the next match. So Bass's friends were all patting him on the back. Because the Big C said, you know, Charlie, how do you think these guys are going to do in that cage with 3 against 4, right? And they left the set. So Charlie, for one of the few times ever, brought his microphone from the set into the ring. And we were still up there, the three of us around Joe, trying to get him back to his senses. And we kind of had him sitting up. You know, and but he was bleeding, man, pretty badly, you know. And so the jawjacker, he called it a Pearl Harbor, man. You know, what a Pearl Harbor this has been, right? Mm-hmm. And so Rob and I said a few words, but Joe was still sitting on in the middle of the ring. He kind of finished it off, and he kind of got out a few words. He said, you know, there's no way I'm going to miss my chance to get even next week. So... Joe meant every word of that. Wow, he was a tough son of a gun.
That had to be one heck. I mean, maybe one of the best endings to a TV show ever. So now that we know who the mystery man was, set it up for us in Mobile, Alabama, in that 10,000-seat arena only 3 days later. What happened there?
Well, Ricky Fields won the opening match against the Avenger. Roy Lee Welch got a big win over Bill Dromo, and I say that because Roy Lee was probably giving up 60 pounds or 70 pounds to Big Bill Dromo. Eddie Boulder and Randy Rose, they wrestled to a 20-minute time limit draw. Great match. I watched them. Both of those guys were great young wrestlers. had big futures. They definitely had big futures. Don Fargo got a very close win over Charlie Cook in the Brass Knucks match. Charlie looked good. Both of those guys ended up bleeding. It was, you know, those Brass Knuck matches were really, really dangerous. Tony Charles regained his United States Junior Heavyweight Championship belt. He won his match over Norvell Austin. Then in the eight-man steel cage match, the team of Ron Bass, the Stomper, the Big C, and Bill Irwin, they got the win with the help of Randy Rhodes. And Rhodes kind of was watching the match, I guess, back there, and he could see what was going to happen, that they were going to get beat. And he turned the tide for him. He ran back into the dressing room. He got Bass's bull rope, which Bass wasn't allowed to bring into the ring for this match. And he also got Bill Irwin's lasso from the dressing room. And he ran down to the ring and he threw him over inside the steel cage to those two guys. They were able to get their hands on the belt, on the bull rope and the rope, the old lasso too. So they were already there was already plenty of blood in the ring, man, from an earlier match. And now, you know, there was a lot of guys bleeding at this point. And the Stomper and the Georgia Jawjacker, they kind of focused on each other. And with the help of the Big C and his loaded glove, which he loaded, and, you know, he popped Rob with it. Rob was already bleeding, and several other guys. And Irwin was, you know, he threw his lasso by Rose, the Rose had got him, and with the help of the Big C, they both tied Rob up, and then they ended up getting me tied. So they were having a field day. The match was finally won when Ron Bass beat Joe LeDuc after Bass had been bloodied by LeDuc earlier in the match. The bull rope was thrown over the cage to Bass. He used that same bell that he had on television three days earlier, and he put LeDuc down again, man, unconscious again, knocked him out, and, you know, he was counted out. So this made two concussions for Joe in only 3 days.
Wow.
You know, and back in those days, you know, there wasn't a lot of talk about concussions, you know, and we didn't realize, I don't think wrestlers especially realized how dangerous these concussions were. Mm. And so, you know, Joe had been out on Saturday, been unconscious. They brought him back 3 days later. He shouldn't have been in the ring, that's for sure. And not in this kind of the match, for
wow.
sure.
Wow.
You know, he gets knocked out again for the second time. So we couldn't get him at two. And so they called an ambulance. And and they took him to the same hospital that they took Jimmy Golden the week earlier. Mm. Same hospital. They came again with an ambulance and took Joe LeDuc this time. He spent a night in the hospital, and he wasn't going to be wrestling again for Southeastern for 10 weeks after that.
Wow, 10 weeks. What a big night, and what a wild match to end everything. So you had to do well on attendance in all three of those major markets. Tell us about that.
Well, man, they were sellouts. I mean, Montgomery sold out. It had 4,500 people. It was the biggest crowd in Montgomery since I had wrestled Harley there 7 weeks earlier. Dothan also sold out, had just over 5,000 in Dothan. And Mobile had 9,200. We drew almost 19,000 fans in three shows, God. Which was more than 6,000 average per event for three events.
Man, that had to be close to what some of the biggest territories were doing on three events. It looks like, hey, I think we are going to have time. Let's do enough time for a learning tree question. So let's see if we can get that in. Our question comes from Ethan Eberhart, Toronto, Canada. He asked, you've talked about your grandfather's wrestling bear. Do you think any other kind of animal might be taught to wrestle?
Boy, I tell you, the ginger stuff, it just he keeps hanging in there, man. And that's a very good question, Ethan. You know, and And I just happened to have a little history with a question like that, you know, and it comes from a true story about my father and his uncle Lester, who were, you know, just about both of them were about the same age. Even though Lester was my dad's uncle, they were within 2 years of being the same age. And they had trained after Ginger had been taken to a zoo. Roy had a deal with the zoo that if she had an offspring, that he was going to be able to get the offspring. And Ginger had a male cub born. And so my dad and Lester, they took that bear and they trained that bear. And they were both in their early 20s and you know, a little nuts, like anybody had to be. If you're going to train a bear to wrestle, you had to be a little nuts. But then they were a little beyond Roy. They began to discuss the possibilities of training another type of animal, you know, and one that, you know, might be good for wrestling, you know, other than just the bear. You know, and this is a great question from, I think it was Ethan in Toronto. I mean, it's a great question because, you know, they kind of got into this discussion. And so they came up with the idea of training a gorilla. Right? So my grandfather, Ginger, you know, my grandfather's Ginger was the only bear that was ever trained to wrestle that had all of her teeth and claws. And all the other wrestling bears that came along after her, some of them had some of their teeth at least, and most of their teeth pulled and all their claws were removed. So, and that had to be very hard on the bear to do that to them. So, you know, so obviously if you're going to train a gorilla, you're going to have to do a whole lot of things to weaken him, right? You'd have to snip tendons out and no telling what all you would have to do. So before you could even consider trying to train him, you were going to have to decide how you're going to limit his power. So they started thinking about then they got the dad said, we got to talking there. And going, said, but think about it. You know, the gorilla's got a lot more potential to be a great wrestling thing but than a bear. You know, you think about the acrobatic things that a gorilla could do, right? You do the leapfrogs, the drop kicks, the backflips. I mean, you know, it was like, wow, they were all enthused about it. They were like, gosh, let's find out. Let's get us one, right? So they actually tracked down a guy that had a young gorilla for sale. And they went to have a look at the gorilla. And so when they saw the gorilla, you know, he was only about 2 years old, Dad said. And Dad said he was maybe 3 feet tall. You know, he had the long arms that hung down, you know. And he said when they went there, he said the gorilla was in a cage. And Lester stayed there and to see what the deal was with the gorilla. And Dad went into this guy's office to talk about buying the gorilla potentially, right? So Lester saw the young gorilla, you know, he had a couple of semi-truck tires laying in the cage, right? And, you know, Lester was kind of, well, wonder what the heck that's all about. And so the gorilla is kind of like he knew what Dad and Lester had in mind, right? So he went over and he picked up one of those truck tires and he kind of drug it over there to where he was right in front of Lester, maybe just feet away from Lester, mm-hmm. right? He had those long gorilla arms and he reached across and grabbed both sides of the tire when, you know, and then it, without with very little exertion, Lester described it, you know, he just took both sides of that big old huge truck tire and he just shoved the sides in and it collapsed the sides of the tire and he just pushed each side of it past the other side. And it made a loud popping noise, you know, like a boom, 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 boom. It was just 4, 5, 6 times, boom, 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 you know, with a truck tire, right? So, and Lester said, you know, he told Dad later on, he said the whole time he was doing it, he said he was staring straight in my eyes. Like, are you watching this? So my father and the owner of the grill, they came out of the office, and they were already talking about the deal, how much they're going to pay and all that. And Lester says, "Hey, Dad," the buddy, he called him the buddy back in the day. He said, "Hey, buddy, yeah, check this out." So Dad got over, and the bear continued the process. I mean, the gorilla continued the process.
Right.
So Dad got a look at it too, man. And he told me, I remember when he told me this story, he said, we both could imagine, you know, what he was doing that tire, what that was going to look like if it was us.
Well, no doubt. For real. Wow.
So thanks for your question, Mr. Everhart. It turns out, you know, bears may be the only animals fit to be wrestlers, I think, possibly. Certainly not a gorilla.
Yeah, the strength of a bear is one thing, and that's many times more than a man. But a gorilla is many, many times more than what a man can imagine. I tell you what, you've done it again, stud. Another remarkable story that could only come from your family as you deep dive into the history. This has been, as usual, a most unusual studcast. All right, so I can't wait until the next one. Speaking of that, where are we going to be riding next week?
Well, we're going to be talking about another sports hidden history lesson, man. We're also going to be returning to the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory. We're going to have a completely new card. The 8-man tags are done at this point. We've had all of them. We've gone to the cage, everything else. So we're going to go back, but we're going to have a stipulation in one of the matches on this next card that's going to be one of the most important and crazy in the history of Southeastern wrestling. It's going to have two title matches, and it's going to have a rare 7 matches in all on this next one. So, and then hopefully we'll have enough time for another learning tree question as well.
Oh, good deal. All right, folks, you know how to get hooked up with the Tennessee Stud. You can find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, on Facebook. Like and follow him there and automatically become friends with a living legend. The same thing on Twitter or X. He's there, too, as Ron Fuller Welch. Follow him there also. Check out the fantastic website at tnstud.com. TNstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the stud store where you can get 43 super studcast, 4 different 8x10 photos, the thrilling lion novel Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts still on sale for only $15.99, all with free shipping. Subscribe now at YouTube Southeastern Rewind. Get the best in old school wrestling. Find 421 videos. The last 122 studcasts, 52 stud stories, 115 short rides with the stud, and now Ask the Stud 16 question and answer show. It's all there, all this exclusively on YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It's the best deal in old school wrestling. If you sit there and watch it from beginning to end with that many 421 videos, you can wear out a spot in the couch. All right. Any final words this week, Ron?
Yeah, man, I'd like to obviously thank everyone for joining us today. And I hope everybody's enjoyed the show. And please tell your friends and neighbors about us. So take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller and the great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC. Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains.